Welcome to the October 18th, 2017 episode of Non-Human Radio, where we talk animal rights and veganism every Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. here on KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico, or streaming online at kzfr.org. You can also find us on Facebook at Non-Human Radio. I'm Jeannie Trezino.
And I'm Danny Toms. Today, Jeannie and I are going to talk about the predictably despicable fur industry. Jeannie, what story do you have for us?
Veg News Magazine and the British Telegraph newspaper reported last week that fashion brand Gucci will ban fur from its clothing lines starting with its spring-summer 2018 collection.
Woohoo.
Gucci CEO Marco Bizzarri announced the news at the London College of Fashion. He said that, quote, being socially responsible is one of Gucci's core values, and Gucci will continue to strive to do better for the environment and animals. Gucci is excited to take this next step and hopes it will inspire innovation and raise awareness, changing the luxury fashion industry for the better, end quote. Another comment that Bizzarri made was that fur is an outdated material and that creativity can come from many different directions instead of using fur. Hear, hear. Animal rights organizations, including the Humane Society of the United States and the Italian chapter of the Fur Free Alliance, Lega Ante Vivisezioni, and the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, have worked for decades to push Gucci and other fashion designers to go fur free. Gucci joins a growing number of fashion brands, including Ralph Lauren, Armani, and Hugo Boss, that have recently removed fur from their clothing lines. Gucci will auction all remaining pieces made with fur and donate the proceeds to HSUS and Lega Ante Vivisezione. The global fur industry is estimated to be worth more than $40 billion a year. I went to the United States fur farming website, furcommission.org, so I could learn a little more about the American fur industry, which, not surprisingly, is very similar to other animal agriculture industries.
Jeannie does a lot for this show. I don't know how many of us would want to go to the Fur Commission website.
Well, I'm not going to get into like how the animals are slaughtered and skinned alive and other such things, but I find it interesting to see how these businesses, these industries are sort of linked.
Right.
And so what I found is that, among other things, the industry works really hard to try to sell the idea that raising and slaughtering animals to sell their skins is a family business, right? Sounds familiar.
Yep.
It's been in my family for generations.
I've heard about that, about people raising meat bunnies. It's like, oh, they're so cute, and you can live them in, you know, keep them in your backyard and then kill them for meat.
I do not even get into the rabbit fur industry in this, in the research, but yeah, that's another area. According to the Fur Commission website, more than 85% of the pelts used in the world's fur trade come from small family-run farms. Oh, my God. In the United States, there are about 275 mink farms in 23 states, and these U.S. farms domestically kill about 3 million animals annually with a value of more than $300 million a year. So that's like a dollar a pelt, a dollar a life. Not worth it.
And I can't do math, but if you got 275 farms with 3 million animals, I mean, how many animals per farm, and is that really a small family-run business?
Exactly, right? We like to give this veneer, put this veneer, this palatable consumer veneer that we're small and family-run. It's just, anyway. Wisconsin is the leading mink-producing state, killing well over 1 million animals every year. Other states with fur farms are Utah, Idaho, Oregon, and Minnesota. Also, according to the Fur Commission website, today's farm-raised mink are among the world's best cared-for livestock. Livestock, right?
Right.
Good nutrition and comfortable housing and prompt veterinary care have resulted in livestock very well-suited to the farm environment. National codes of practice and operating guidelines provide further assurance that farmed fur-bearing animals are well cared for. So, mink are raised in small cages, not that different from battery-caged hens.
Right.
This is not a free-roaming animal in the fur industry, in the fur farming industry. Additionally, fur farming across the United States is linked to other forms of animal agriculture. For instance, there's a feed mill in Salt Lake City, Utah. That's why Utah is one of the top states with fur farming industries. And about 150 50 fur farms are clustered around that feed mill. That feed mill takes production byproducts from dairies and turkey, duck, and chicken farms from about 8 states in the western United States, from all the way up in Alaska, where it takes in fish byproducts, and all the way down to Southern California, which is also another fish byproduct and chicken byproduct industry. Mink farms in Wisconsin use dead, dying, and culled male chicks from hatcheries to feed the minks. So if you think eating eggs is a harmless way to eat, a harmless food to eat, you are contributing to the fur industry. The feed mill also buys about 3 million pounds per year of off-grade pet food from Utah and California manufacturers. And interestingly, the mink feed mill companies compete with the pet food industry for like base level animal byproducts.
There's so much cruelty going on there. It's hard to even parse.
Exactly, right? It's so linked, and it's all couched in a win-win type of economy.
Right. It's like this food is not suitable for your pets, which you love, but it's good enough for these other animals we're going to kill, but we treat them very well according to the guidelines we're not going to mention from the feds. Yeah. And it's just...
But it gets worse.
Yeah.
Another source of mink food, a lunch meat supplier sells the feed mill between 10 and 20,000 pounds per day of waste and products no longer fit for human consumption. So there's like your bologna, your Oscar Mayer bologna.
Yeah.
And then on the other end, after the animals are skinned, and I'm not going to torture you with the horrors involved with that, but let's just say there's no humane way to skin a mink or any animal. On the other end, the mink bodies are then rendered to produce mink oil, which is used in the leather and tire industry. It's pervasive. And they're also, these rendered bodies of the minks are also sold to the crab industry for bait, right?
I'm trying to remember the last time I saw a crab running out of the ocean, chasing a carnivore.
Right. These animal industries are interlinked. They all generate waste products. They're all trying to figure out ways to make money off of that. And this is how they do it. The majority of animals killed for their fur are kept captive in fur farms. But each year, trappers kill hundreds of thousands of muskrats, beavers, raccoons, coyotes, squirrels, martens. I mean, that's a big weasel, basically. Mm. It's a big mink. It's not very common. It's a magnificent, well-adapted predator for northern climates with snow, and yet these things are trapped. The United States and Canada are the world's leading suppliers of fur from trapped animals, which is known as wild fur in the industry. So even as we have designers like Gucci and others not using fur, and we see a decline somewhat in fur wearing in the United States, what happens is these pelts that are being collected by trappers in the United States or by these fur farms are being exported. So, and that we'll get to in another story. You're listening to Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio, hosted by Jeannie Trezino and Danny Toms. What do we have next, Danny?
All right, I should preface this by saying I went to the eye doctor earlier today and got my eyes dilated and wore some super cool shades on my way over here, so it's a little hard to read the copy. We'll see how much I screw up. This story, though, is about the Los Angeles Times reporting last month that several conservation groups filed a lawsuit in September of this year to force California state wildlife authorities to raise license fees to cover the full cost of regulating the trapping and killing of wild animals. Camilla Fox, executive director of Project Coyote, one of the groups suing the state, said that the intent is to drive the trapping license fees so high that it would effectively kill off the trade. Trapping was introduced, of course, centuries ago by California's first explorers and settlers. We can often remember from history the different fads of different dead animal hats that people have worn over time. Camilla Fox went on to say that she hoped the filing of this lawsuit would be remembered as the moment California said goodbye to the handful of people who still kill these mammals so that their pelts can be auctioned off in foreign markets and then made into slippers and fur-trimmed coats. You might be thinking this seems unfair to the folks, but keep listening. The lawsuit filed against the California Department of Fish and Wildlife and the State Fish and Game Commission alleges the revenue generated from the 200 commercial trapping licenses purchased in 2016 covered only a fraction of the state trapping program's total costs.
200 licenses.
200 licenses.
In the whole state of California.
So that means that you and me and all the other taxpayers are actually subsidizing the ability for these folks to go out and kill small mammals. The lawsuit argues that taxpayers, by the way, we often seem to subsidize other people killing animals.
Absolutely.
For unprofitable businesses. The lawsuit argues that taxpayers are illegally subsidizing the state wardens, biologists, and other administrators needed to oversee and enforce trapping regulations. The lawsuit was filed in Alameda County Superior Court in September by the nonprofit group Center for Biological Diversity and Project Coyote.
So Center for Biological Diversity, we've talked about them many times on the show, but one of the things I remember, one of their projects was they're the ones who created the stickers that showed how many endangered species were attached to X or Y, like hamburger, in terms of habitat destruction caused by that hamburger. So anyway.
The plaintiff said the cost of a commercial trapping license would have to be increased by at least tenfold in order for the industry to be self-sustaining under state wildlife codes.
Right. So there's a code that says, trappers, hunters, your fees for your licenses need to cover our cost of overseeing what you're doing to pay for the professionals to monitor these things.
So in regards to this, state wildlife authorities declined to comment. However, 35 years ago, there were over 3,500 trappers in California. So you can kind of see how economically, at least, it was probably paying for itself. But changing international markets, the growth of the fur farms we've mentioned, and the growing ranks of animal rights activists, and I would just say, you know, decent, kind human beings who don't want to buy fur, have combined to make it difficult to turn a profit. Of the 200 people who purchased a license in 2016, 50 killed nearly 2,000 mammals for their pelts, according to a department report. The market value of the trapped species was low. A coyote pelt fetches about $30, a muskrat's only about $3. The most commonly trapped species permitted by the state fish and game code are foxes, coyotes, badgers, skunks, muskrats, weevils, raccoons, opossums, and beavers.
Opossums, right? I don't even understand that.
You know, I mean, I think much as hunters like to hunt and kill things, trappers begin to like to do it. You know, it's the money not even be the reward.
I was researching Alaska and how, so there's like travel packages for people to run trapping lines.
Right, same as
camp, a vacation.
The canned duck hunts we get around here. I mean, I don't know who these things impress. The Fish and Game Commission has banned the trapping of river otters, desert kit foxes, and red foxes, among other species. Most recently, the commission also banned all commercial bobcat trapping in 2015.
That was really surprising.
Yeah.
And most welcome.
Yeah, I don't even, when's the last time you saw a bobcat? I don't know. Maybe it's because they were trapping them. The commission said that the estimated 100 commercial bobcat trappers still working in the state at the time could not afford to pay the costs of regulating their activities as required by a mandate enacted in 2013. These costs ranged from $212,000 to more than $600,000 for bobcat trappers alone in 2015. The commission said, making the bobcat trapping industry unsustainable. Project Coyote and the Center for Biological Diversity are making the same case for the remainder of the trapping permits in California. I mean, think of people making a living wage in California and making, you know, 70, 80, 90 grand a year. And if this takes 5 or 6 people to oversee all these things.
Oh, right. Yeah.
That's it. You're done.
Yeah.
You know, you can't, you know, this low level of cost. Not that we approve of it anyway, but this is really something that's simply archaic and expensive and should be done with. So hopefully this suit works.
Yeah, I hope to report an update and that, you know, that we'll see a cessation of these commercial trapping permits in the state of California. So thanks. You're listening to Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio hosted by Jeannie Trezino and Danny Toms. And in our final news piece on fur, in March of this year, the U.S. Senate approved a bill that repealed Obama-era hunting restrictions on national wildlife refuges in Alaska. The House had already voted to abolish those restrictions, which had been instituted by the Fish and Wildlife Service in 2016 under President Barack Obama. The bill repealing those regulations was signed by President Trump in April of this year. The Fish and Wildlife Service rule that was repealed had explicitly prohibited many types of predator control actions on federally owned refuges in Alaska. Their prohibitions included a ban on the aerial hunting, live trapping, or baiting of predators such as bears and wolves, as well as banning the killing of bears and wolves while near or in their dens or their cubs. Now, these cruel actions are legal. Alaska Representative Don Young, the Republican sponsor of the bill, stated that these restrictions represented federal overreach, a state's rights issue of self-determination. We've seen this issue come up before with the BLM and the occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Oregon. We see it with Clive and Bundy failing to pay BLM grazing fees for his cattle and feeling that it was his right to use public lands basically without compensating the federal agencies. Other representatives, like Democratic Mayor Senator Maria Cantwell of Washington State, disagreed at the time, saying that this was not a state's rights issue, but instead a federal issue of managing wildlife refuges to the degree that agencies believe is necessary for the preservation of wildlife heritage areas, right? We set aside these refuges for a reason.
I mean, when is a refuge not a refuge?
Exactly.
Apparently when it's in Alaska.
The Alaska Dispatch News pointed out that the debate gets to the core of a long-running dispute, writing in its coverage that, quote, at the heart of the disagreement between state and federal wildlife managers is what each group thinks should guide its purpose. The federal government has argued that the goal on refuges and in parks should be biodiversity. The Alaska State Board of Game has an interest in ensuring maximum sustained populations for hunting, that is, hunting of other species.
Well, you know, and they're going to have to hunt them because without the predators, they're overpopulating and they're going to starve to death.
Exactly.
And that's the next argument in this chain.
Who sits on the Alaska State Board of Game? The profiles of the seven members of the Alaska Board of Game explains that action. One is a safari club trophy hunter. Another is a trapper. Another is a hunter and a guide, so he makes his living on this business. Another is an NRA member with a background in hunting and trapping. Another actively involved member of the NRA, another one is a trapper and a bow hunter, and finally, a hunting lodge manager, right? These are not environmentalists. These are not people who value these ecosystems over their profit or pleasure motives. Ensuring the maximum sustained populations of commonly hunted prey species like elk, moose, and caribou means reining in the populations of their predators, at least in this model. And those predators are bears and wolves. This is similar to the way that we see sea lions and cormorant populations being managed in the Pacific Northwest because those animals prey on salmon runs, or the way coyotes are hunted down in the cattle ranching areas in California. Federal regulations in 2016 argued that the Alaska Board of Game had gone too far in prioritizing prey populations, that is the elk and moose, over predators. This was an argument pursued by several Democratic senators, including New Jersey's Cory Booker, and other environmental groups who are opposed to the rollback. The Center for Biological Diversity, that's the also group that we mentioned in the second story, was quoted at the time as saying, "This is not hunting, it's slaughter. Killing wolves and bears in this cruel, unsportsmanlike fashion is outrageous, especially in national wildlife refuges that belong to all Americans. Additionally, repealing the protections also undermines the critical role predators play in healthy ecosystems."
And I don't know if you get into this in this article, but I mean, I can guarantee you the majority of these animals are not being killed by locals. You know, these are people flying to Alaska to decimate their large game and then fly back home and, you know, literally destroying, you know, some other state's ecosystem, you know, for their own pleasure.
An analysis that I read in the Chicago Tribune by the former Federal Fish and Wildlife Services Director Dan Ash said that if the Alaska Board of Game believed that the Fish and Wildlife Service had overstepped its authority by curbing these methods of hunting down bears and wolves, then it should have taken the Fish and Wildlife Service to court. And actually, Alaska has done that in the past and has prevailed in their lawsuits. But according to former Director Dan Ash, the reason that the Board of Game did not pursue that route this time was because they knew they would lose in court. The Sierra Club reports that despite Gucci and other fashion designers opting out of using fur, The market is growing for U.S. river otter, gray wolf, and brown bear skins, with prices per pelt rising beyond $300 as demand increases in China, Europe, and Russia. Over the last 5 years, the Center for Biological Diversity has found that an average of 80,000 pelts of these animals have been legally exported from under the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Wildlife Export Program. That program is actually relatively recent. It began in 1977 and operated for decades without environmental impact assessments. In 2016, Wild Earth filed suit, also followed by the Center for Biological Diversity again in this lawsuit, and forced the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to issue a draft assessment in spring of this year to analyze the fur trade's impact on bobcats and other species, including wolves and brown bears. And the reason why tracking this information is important is because all these species, river otters, bobcats, gray wolves, lynx, and brown bears, are all protected under the CITES agreement, which is an international treaty to ensure that trade in wildlife does not threaten a species' survival. Trade of these species is allowed in so far as it will not be detrimental to the survival of species in the wild. So Alaska and Montana are allowed to export the pelts of gray wolves, which have just begun to recover and stabilize after nearly being eradicated in the western U.S. Allowing the export of wolf pelts helps create a demand for gray wolf fur on the international market, and of course will adversely affect the future growth and recovery of these wolf populations. So that's sort of a mishmash of a lot of different efforts that are going on that threaten the wolf in North America. But I think it's important to realize that markets internationally are growing, and that's part of the impetus for some of the rollback on these formerly protected species. This is Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio.
All right, now it is time for the Chico Animal Rights Calendar events. Get ready to mark your calendars.
All right, thanks, Danny. There are some great events to put on your calendar coming up this month. If you need more info, please send me an email at chicovegan@gmail.com or message me at Non-Human Radio on Facebook. Just a heads up, foodie tip of the week. There is a new gallery that just opened on Park Avenue, Blackbird Books Gallery and Cafe. They're located at 1431 Park Avenue, and they are offering some scrumptious vegan baked goods, coffee with a lot of non-dairy creamers, and it's just a good vibe there. A bookstore associated with AK Press and some other radical book publishers. Coming up tomorrow night, Thursday, October 19th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Paradise Adventist Fellowship Hall is a class on plant-based starts and finishes, a cooking class talking about appetizers and desserts. There'll be door prizes, new recipes, and a great sense of community. You can pre-register by calling 877-4454, and that's tomorrow night from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Paradise Adventist Fellowship Hall in Paradise. Coming up on Saturday, October 21st, is the Animal Rights March in UC Berkeley. Saturday, October 21st, from 12 to 3 p.m. at UC Berkeley, activists from Berkeley are hosting their first official Animal Rights March with support from PETA, Direct Action Everywhere, the SAVE Movement, Vegans of the Bay, and the Berkeley Organization for Animal Advocacy. Saturday, November 11th, is the 2017 Toast to the Turkey Celebration at Harvest Home Animal Sanctuary in Stockton, California. From 12 to 4 p.m., you can join Harvest Home's annual sanctuary for a compassionate tradition this November in honor of the rescued turkeys at Harvest Home Animal Sanctuary. You can purchase your ticket at toasttotheturkeys.org. The following week, Saturday, November 18th, is Thank the Turkeys at Animal Place from 3 to 6 p.m. Animal Place is the farmed animal sanctuary in Grass Valley, California. You can join them for their 8th annual Thank the Turkey celebration in honor of the lovely rescue turkeys at the sanctuary and as a reminder of why we fight to end the mistreatment of and abuse of turkeys. Let's see, you can get tickets at animalplace.org. And save the date for Sunday, November 19th, for the 5th annual Chico Vegan Thanksgiving Potluck. It's be from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Chico Women's Club in Chico. This is a big annual bash for the Chico Vegan Group, where we enjoy the vegan Thanksgiving that we wish we could have with our friends and family, but that we often can't. Ticket information you can see at chicovegan.com, and you can go ahead and buy your ticket there. And that is about it for our calendar. Again, if you have an event or other news to share, send an email to chicovegan@gmail.com and tell me all about it. And we have one last piece of business to take care of, and that is the Animal Rights Quote of the Week. Take it away, Danny.
Our quote of the week is from George Bernard Shaw from his 1901 play, The Devil's Disciple. "The worst sin towards our fellow creatures is not to hate them, but to be indifferent to them. That's the essence of inhumanity."
And I think here, you know, George Bernard Shaw meant creatures in its full range of definitions, not just humans, but also including all of our four-legged non-human animal friends.
Smart guy. Non-human radio is made possible through the generous contributions of KZFR listeners like you. Many thanks to Sue Hildebrand for her engineering assistance and moral support. Stay tuned for Sue's show, The Real Issue, coming up next.
This has been Non-Human Radio, a production of KZFR 90.1 FM Chico. The views and opinions expressed on this broadcast are those of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of KZFR, its board, its volunteers, or its staff. We do, however, reflect the opinions of our non-human fellow earthlings who would rather not be killed and eaten, hunted, raced, experimented upon, and otherwise abused.
Our theme music is Ready to Fall by vegan activist Rockers Rise Against. If you missed any portion of this show or you want to listen over and over again, go to the archives at kzfr.org and look for Non-Human Radio. This is Danny Toms and Jeannie Trezino signing off. Until next week, be different, be better, be kind.
And go vegan. And this is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Street.